ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival for Tuesday night, 10th, 2017. James Corbett will be joining us from the Corbett Report. James will be calling in from Japan after the first break, and he should be here in about 20 minutes. In the meantime, we'll take a look at today's market reports and a couple articles to talk about. And again, James Corbett should be joining us shortly. Was since today to $1,219.80 per ounce. Silver was up 2 cents, $16.27 per ounce. Platinum was up $7 to $915. Palladium was flat at $801. What have we got down here in the paper markets? And the U.S. dollar index, for example, was up. Well, it's up 0.08 right now. It's at the moment it's 99.65, so it's rising again, coming up toward the 100 mark. It was down below that. I think it was in the 98 range, and now it's coming back up again. Crude oil is up $1.46 to $47.34 per ounce. Dow Jones is down 33 points to 20,943. NASDAQ is up 9 points to 6,129. New York Stock Exchange is up 31 to 11,599. Standard & Poor's is up almost 3 points to 2,399. Not quite 2,400. They haven't quite close to 2,400 on the Standard & Poor's yet. Articles here to talk about, and both of them are ultimately from Warren Buffett. And we'll see if we get to both of them here in the time that's left. Here's one from Yahoo Finance, and it was, the headline is Warren Buffett, One Metric Tells Me the Most About the Future. This is Warren Buffett describing to people what he thinks are the most important index and information to follow when you're investing. And the other people would have different opinions. But the article says Warren Buffett made a name for himself and became a multi-billionaire by making some savvy moves in the stock market. So it might surprise some stock market that for stock market investors, the most important metric to watch is found in the bond market. Recently, Buffett's been fielding a lot of questions, and he said, how do you value stocks? How do you value individuals? And he said, everything in valuation gets back to interest rates. At Berkshire Hathaway's recent shareholder meeting, an investor asked Buffett about the relevance of two popular measures in the stock market value, cap to GDP. Buffett once heralded as probably the single best measure for valuation stand at any given moment, and two, the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, CAPE index, price to earnings ratio, which was made famous by Nobel Prize winner Robert Shiller and was seen as accurately predicting the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble. Buffett points out, he says, every number, right, every one of these indexes has some degree of meaning. It means more sometimes than others. And both of the things that you've mentioned get bandied about a lot. It's not that they're unimportant. They can be very important. Sometimes they can be almost totally important. But what he's pointing out is that it changes. At any given moment, the most important index can be something entirely different than what it was yesterday, the day before, or a month before. The value of the indexes that are used to calculate the value of the stocks are themselves in a state of flux. Which index is most important when it comes to figuring out what's the value of a particular stock? Should I buy it? If it's $100 a share, should I buy it or should I give it a pass? Is it overpriced or is it underpriced? The most important thing, nevertheless, Buffett says, the most important thing is future interest rates. And people frequently plug in the current interest rate, saying that's the best they can do. After all, it does reflect the market's judgment. Well, that's not exactly true. Current interest rates are not a reflection of the market's judgment necessarily. They are a reflection of what the Federal Reserve wants to do to stimulate or slow the economy. So it's not necessarily, I don't agree with Buffett where he says the current interest rate reflects the market's judgment. I think it's been manipulated, and the current interest rate has been, it tends to mislead us. He goes on, a couple other points. He said, let me just slide through this article a little bit. He says, if I could only pick one statistic to ask you about in the future, I would ask you what the interest rate is going to be over the next 20 years on average. He says, if these future rates were guaranteed, current rates, excuse me, were guaranteed to stay low for the next 10, 15, or 20 years, then the stock market is dirt cheap right now. And what he's saying is that as long as we have near zero interest rates, even if they are raising them by a quarter of a percent, which is a triviality, well, it seems like a triviality, as long as we have low interest rates, the value of stocks should continue to rise upward, up, and up. Right? And he says, if these rates were guaranteed to stay low for another 10, 15, 20 years, the stock market is dirt cheap right now. You should go out. If you knew for a fact, if you were convinced that interest rates were going to stay low for the next 10, 15, 20 years, then now's the time to buy stock. But he goes on, he says, and this is what really, I don't know, this is the point that really attracted my attention. He said, Buffett publicly endorses discounted cash flow analysis for which you get the intrinsic value. He calls it the ultimate formula. Buffett explained, indeed, the formula for valuing all assets that are purchased for financial gain has been unchanged since it was first laid out by a very smart man in about 600 B.C., And if you haven't already seen reference to this article or to Buffett's remarks, you might be wondering, 600 B.C., 600, we're talking 2,600 years ago. And this guy, according to Buffett, laid out the formula for valuing all assets. And he goes on, he says, the oracle was Aesop, and his enduring, though somewhat incomplete, investment insight was, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. All right? Now, that sounds kind of silly. It kind of sounds overly simplex, simple. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And this is what, this principle for investment. Pressure. Is there really an opportunity here? Is there something that can be purchased that has value, right? Two, when will they emerge and how many will there be? When are the birds coming out of the bush? If we have a new technology developing and it's going to be available next week, then now's the time to buy, right? On the other hand, if a new technology is developing and it won't be available for another 5 years, now is not the time to buy. In other words, it's not going to emerge from the bush anytime soon, so maybe we can wait a while before we buy that technology. Third question is, what is the risk-free interest rate, which we consider to be the yield on long-term U.S. bonds? Now, if you're struggling to understand what Buffett's talking about, in his 2010 letter to shareholders, he wrote, to update Aesop, a girl in a convertible is worth five in the phone book. All right, he's saying a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And he's saying to parallel, he's saying a girl in a convertible is worth five in a phone book. All right? More valuable. Talking about value. Which is more valuable? Which should you pursue at this particular moment? And what I'm looking at is I'm saying, how about a coin in the hand is worth two in the bush? Or how about an ounce of physical gold in hand is currently worth about 500 ounces of paper gold in the COMEX bush. And the point I'm trying to illustrate here, I agree with Buffett. I agree with the idea that a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And that's what gold coins are. They are the bird in the hand. They are that substance, that investment that has intrinsic value. And if you hold it in your hand, now you have, that is worth two gold coins that is not, that are not in your hand, according to Aesop. And according perhaps to comics, where as many of you understand, there's only one ounce of gold in the comics market for something like 500 ounces of paper gold that are being traded. People are buying gold on comics, but all they're really buying is paper gold, and they're betting on it. Right? They're speculating. They're betting. But if the time ever comes where everybody says, "Well, I don't want to bet anymore. I want my gold," then comics is going to have to admit, "Well, sorry, Charlie, we've only got 1 ounce of gold for each of the 500 ounces of paper gold that have been sold into the market." Which means 499 people out of 500 will not get any gold. And when it turns out that their paper is worthless, they will be distraught. Well, my main point here is simply to illustrate that when he talks about a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, a coin in the hand is worth two in the comics market. All right, and maybe even worth 500 in the comics market. And the lesson here, the implication, assuming that Aesop is correct, that a bird in the hand is really worth two in the bush, or at least two in the bush, assuming that Buffett is correct, and Buffett ought to have a clue. He's one of the wealthiest investors the world's ever seen, one of the two or three. He knows what he's talking about, and when he says a bird in the hand, so he's saying don't take unnecessary risk. If you got to do it, work with something that's solid right now. And he's not saying no risk whatsoever, but he's saying you have to calculate that risk. You've got to sit back and say, well, should I take the sure thing, which is the bird in the hand, or the coin in the hand, shall I take the sure thing right now, or shall I stick my neck out and go for something in paper? No, that's the essence of this article from Buffett that I wanted to bring forward. And no, the coin in the hand is worth two in the bush. I think it's a good investment philosophy. It's at least a good investment consideration. Here's another one. Buffett was quoted in Business Insider in an article entitled, "Be Very, Very Suspicious of a Budget Trick Trump is About to Use." And it's called dynamic scoring. Everybody wants a cut in taxes, and if they do, they can hire some academics. And the academics look for dynamic scoring, all right? And they say that the country will really be better off if we pay less taxes. And what they mean by dynamic scoring is that it allows economists to pick and choose among the economic models that they want to use to support a particular argument. And he's saying there's scores of arguments. There's scores of economic models that you can pick from. And if you want to pitch the idea that we can lower taxes now and it will actually stimulate the economy in order to generate more tax revenue, we actually make more tax revenue at lower taxes, and that's the pitch, then everybody's going to go for this. And you say, yes, yes, lower taxes. I mean, it's obvious because it will actually get more revenue with lower taxes. It will stimulate the economy. Well, there are business models out there that will support that idea. And under this concept of dynamic scoring, you get to choose which business model you want to support your whatever it is you're trying to advocate. And so dynamic scoring is kind of like fake news. Or maybe we should just call it fraud. Huh? If we have people come up and they say, well, I'm an economist. I have a PhD in economics. And I went to Harvard. Or I went wherever, you know. And they are going to tell us what's happening in the economy. And they speak with apparent authority. But the truth of the matter is they don't really know what's going on. And none of us do. The whole thing is something of a mystery. And although some controls and indexes and whatever seem to work at times, even as Buffett pointed out, none of these indexes work to the same degree all the time. Sometimes an index is powerful, sometimes it's not. There is an element of uncertainty in everything that's economic and modern in modern society. And to sit back and say, well, we understand what this is exactly. We understand that no one does. No one does. The whole thing is something of a mystery. It's like a man driving a car that doesn't have any speedometer on it, doesn't have any oil gauge, doesn't have any gasoline gauge, doesn't have, you know, you don't know how fast you're going, you don't know if you're legal, you're illegal, do the turn signals work, don't work, because they don't flash inside the vehicle. What are you doing here? There's a certain amount of just flying by the seat of your pants and by dumb luck or the grace of God when you're running in a, when you're running a an economy. But he goes on, he says, those imagined benefits when added to budget projections, and boom, you've got a healthy looking balance sheet for America. This is what happens if you correct, if you establish the, make the right dynamic scoring choice. You can put these presumptions together and projections together and imagine benefits together, and here's the pitch. Hooray, we're all going to get rich. But the article continues and says, we've argued that this is nothing more than massive generational theft. And they're talking about the idea that we will cut taxes now and we will actually generate more revenue in the future. And the article is describing this as massive generational theft. And I would say that it's a con job. It's a massive pyramid scheme. Dynamic scoring is simply a fancy language for cooking the books. It's a massive deception to convince people that they have a free, that they can have a free lunch today without alerting them that the bill will be sent to their children and grandchildren. And there's an implication here. The idea is adults are generally more moral and than I have suspected, and therefore reluctant to knowingly leave their debt to the kids, which means for government to engage, advance the idea of deficit spending, we need to be persuaded that the bill will not be left to our children and our grandchildren. And the way they get around the guilt of leaving the debt to the children and grandchildren and put them in, putting them into a debt bondage, the way government gets away from that is they say, oh no, see, if we cut taxes now, we will actually generate more revenue, and the additional revenue in the future, then the kids don't have to pay for it. It'll be no burden on the children. So we are being responsible and moral adults when, in fact, if we were going to be responsible and moral adults, we would pay as we go. There would be no deficit financing. There would be no government borrowing. There would be no increased national debt. We would, if you want it now, you pay for it now. The generation that wants it is the generation that has to pay for it. No leaving the deficit for future generations. Well, it's fun to see the implication that is perhaps the American people are far more moral than we had previously supposed. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. I'll be back shortly with James Corbett from CorbettReport.com. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Some of the best and most insightful, intelligent commentary you're going to find on the internet, on geopolitics, economics, socio-political topics of interest. I've got, hello, James, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you for having me on.
And see, I asked you how you're doing.
And I answered.
Yeah, but you didn't say I can't complain. I thought that was a rule on this program. You answered, well, I can't complain. I got an article here from Reuters. And the headline is Mexico's 2016 murder tally exceeds those of many countries at war. All right? And they are complaining that Mexican's militarized drug battle increasingly resembles an armed conflict. And they say since taking office in 2012, Mexican President Peña Nieto's administration has been scarred by stubbornly weak growth, a perception of corruption, and confused tactics about how to end the decade's drug violence that has killed over 100,000 people. Now, I've gone to Mexico a couple of times. I hitchhiked down there when I was a kid, 18 years old. Me and a friend of mine, we went downstate for 3 months. I've been back a number of times. Lived on 80 cents a day the first time I went down there. I understand Mexico a little bit. I'm not a student of the rest of it, but I understand it a little bit. And I understand that there is an enormous income inequality. I had a friend, passed away about 6-8 months ago now. He has relatives, sisters, who and family members who live down in Mexico City, and they're rich. And all they do is they associate with other rich people, and what they do is they have a party at my house today, which is lavishly catered, and then they have the tomorrow we have the party at your house, which will be lavishly catered, and then the day after that we have a party at Todd's house, the producer, which will be lavishly catered. And there are people that are starving to death, they're certainly hungry in Mexico. And what I'm trying to get to is this: is the problem we see in Mexico, is this alleged drug war really about drugs? Or is this war, this alleged drug war, is this evidence of a political revolution that's attempting to overthrow the Mexican government and the Mexican oligarchy and install a government that's more friendly to the Mexican people? You follow what I'm saying?
I do, and it's a good question. I guess it goes to the heart of a lot of the social and history and context that underlies problems like this. And I can't speak to all of this because, of course, I'm not a student of Mexico. I've only ever stepped foot in Mexico once to attend the Anarcopoco conference in Acapulco a couple of years ago. So I'm not an expert by any means, but I think you are driving at what is probably the central part of this issue, which is not that it's about drugs per se in and of themselves. Yeah. It's about any area of the economy that is made into this black market is obviously going to attract the nefarious sorts that like to make money by trading in things that are outlawed by the government. And that is a manifestation of the underlying problem of Mexican society, which is very little opportunity for economic advancement. So people will often be involved in illicit manners of getting their foot in the door, economically speaking. And I think, again, that's probably a reflection of things that happen in the lower social strata of the American society as well. Again, people at the bottom rung of the economic ladder, one of the easy ways to make it up is to engage in drug dealing, things like that. Now, obviously, in Mexico, it's much more institutionalized with the different mafias, basically, that are trying to carve out their territory. But I think it's it's more of an economic situation than it is about the drugs themselves, per se.
But is it, when we talk about an economic situation, is it even just economics? And I know that's critical, and that's the firing pin and the rest of that sort of thing in this problem, but does this go to politics in a fundamental way, where the oligarchy that runs Mexico, and it really is my understanding, Mexico's run by an oligarchy. The rich people run it, and the poor people just, they get what the crumbs that are handed out by the nobles, essentially. Is this a political problem? Are we looking at the foundation? Is the drug war fueled just by economics? Is it fueled just by greed? Or is it fueled by a need, a real need for revolution in Mexico? Political. Is the cause political?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right about that. I mean, we talk about the economic disparity or otherwise between the, you know, ruling rich and the poor in a lot of the different countries, including the United States. But obviously, it's much more pronounced in Mexico, where, I mean, you look at the Mexican parliament, and it is not representative of the overall, you know, demography of Mexico in any way, ethnically speaking, or social, or political, or economically speaking. And there really is that disparity that goes on. And of course, the only other challenge to that power, that political power, comes in the gangs, the mafia, the different elements of the drug war. So I think that's what we see, is that's where the resistance plays out, is in basically not exactly in anything that benefits the people. It's just in, you know, which part of what ruling sector of what class of the oligarchy is going to rule over people. So I think you're right. I mean, I think that ultimately this is a political problem that needs a more fundamental political solution than the ones that are on the table for voters that, you know, go to the ballot box every few years. But then again, I mean, it's a question of the greater historical context and what the Mexican people can do, and what they have attempted to do, and what is going on in places like Oaxaca and other places that are completely excluded from the mainstream media circles that report on Mexico as if it's just one total whole. You know, it would be reporting on the United States as if Texas is the same as New York, is the same as Chicago, is the same as LA. I mean, obviously, all these places are vastly different. And I think that has to be taken into account. And same in the Mexican political situation, which is why I wouldn't get into too much of the details of it, because, again, I'm not an expert by any means on Mexico.
Well, I think the next point on this is, as an impoverished peon, clearly you can't do much to fight the oligarchy. What about if you're dealing drugs and you're actually making some money? Does the sale of drugs actually empower what may turn out to be political revolutionaries before this is all over? Does it give them currency and money, and therefore they have the ability to resist the oligarchy, which they could not do as mere peons? You see what I'm saying? Is the drugs, it becomes a necessity, it becomes an opportunity for political revolution that might not be possible otherwise.
I see what you're saying. My understanding would be that what you're saying would be an aspirational thing. Wouldn't it be nice if these valiant drug dealers were leading some sort of political revolution to give power to the poor people? I think ultimately what this seems to be, at least from my perspective, is more that the money and the power and the influence that the drug war and the drug dealing affords these different mafia gangs is used to buy influence. Mexico, obviously a notoriously corrupt state with corrupt officials all the way up and down the chain of command. And I think that the money basically buys influence or buys the ability to get officials to look the other way or to help you out here and there. And I think that's more the way that this is looked at, that as I think in every country to some extent, the central government is a trough to feed from, and the drug dealers get to be the first in line because they're the ones with the money to buy access to that trough.
Well, we'll watch and see, but the truth, you know, what little I know about Mexico, and I know a little bit, I've been there half a dozen times probably, but I've begun not a student, and it was years ago, but still, corruption is rampant and, in fact, institutionalized. They call it the mordita, meaning the little bite. And if you want to get information from somebody, you got to pay them. You got to pay them some cash. If you want directions, if you want a book, if you want whatever, everybody gets a tip. The cop gets tipped. Everybody gets a mordita, a little bribe on there. I think it's evidence of an institutionalized corruption. And is that all by itself? Does it help to keep the Mexican people in poverty? Is corruption conducive to poverty? That's what I'm getting to. I know that some people think if you're corrupt, you get to rob more people. I can steal more if I'm a crook. But to the average person, if they accept corruption, does that mean they're likely to stay locked in poverty until they begin to get some sort of moral values?
I think so, and I think that works on a number of levels, perhaps the most insidious of which is that when you internalize and accept the institutionalization of corruption, the way up that ladder is to participate in the corruption.
Yeah.
And that means if you come into access to money, or the more money you make, then the more palms you grease on your way up that ladder, and the more you've basically feed into the system, so that once you actually ascend that ladder, if you actually do manage to make it up a few rungs, then you actually have an investment in that system, and you not only have internalized it, but you actively want it to continue. Especially if you get into a position of actual power, of course, then you want the corruption system to continue because it ends up directly benefiting you. So I think that it creates the perverse false incentives, the incentives for people to actually keep the corruption in place. And that's a mindset. I think you're right. It is a mindset that has to be combated before real political change can happen at any level.
Are we saying that only immoral people can become truly prosperous?
I think that is the case, and I mean, I wouldn't put any country on a pedestal here. I think that you do get outbreaks of freedom here and there, or people with a more freedom-oriented mindset and people who are more willing to stand up to corruption and cronyism, but it doesn't always last. And I think the United States might be a good example of that. There was a time a couple of hundred years ago where people were willing to fight and die for what they thought were their principles of liberty and freedom, and we just want to be left alone. And that created one of the most prosperous societies on the face of the planet in the history of the world. And people have been coasting on that for a number of generations now. And you see the moral degradation that I think is taking place in the U.S. and elsewhere right now. And with that comes the sort of economic deterioration that we're seeing as well.
Do you think, you know, people allege that Hollywood has played a role in this moral degradation? Do you think those complaints are legitimate, exaggerated? Is there a malicious conspiracy coming out of Hollywood to make us an immoral or amoral people in order to destroy our national fiber? Or is this just, you know, just they're just making some movies and having some fun?
Well, I don't have the documents to prove what agenda may or may not be being pushed by which, you know, director or producer or company, but I think it is indisputable that the media that we consume shapes our worldview. And so it doesn't even necessarily have to be a consciously directed process, although I think to some extent it is, but even if it wasn't, just the types of ideas that get fed out into the public consciousness through the media and then get regurgitated when those people who are consuming that media grow up to become media producers of their own, they feed back into that loop and it becomes a sort of spiral. And so we see that, for example, in the music industry where, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the things that Madonna had to do to shock the world and get people to pay attention now seem extremely tame compared to the next iteration of that, you know, the Britney Spears, and then you get the Lady Gagas, and then you get the Miley Cyruses, and whatever else. Hopefully I'm getting too old to keep up with it. But yeah, I mean, so it is that kind of ratcheting up that happens, and it becomes a feedback loop where it has to push the line further and further. And it is remarkable to think about the types of standards that were in place for Hollywood movies, for example, back in the 50s, and when that those blocks came off, when when people were basically allowed to go crazy, it deteriorated quite rapidly to the point where we're at right now. And there are a lot of different things that feed into that, but one of them certainly is the media and the way that it shapes our perception of what the world is.
And how we should behave. It teaches us how to conduct ourselves. It has replaced our parents to some degree. I can recall the movie Peyton Place. I think it came out in the late 50s. And oh my gosh, it was shocking. They had a second or two of a woman running in front of a vehicle at night. The headlights are on her and she was apparently naked. And you just caught it. It was indistinct. Oh my gosh, this Peyton Place. Oh my gosh. And the people who complained that it was attacking moral fiber were generally ridiculed and shown to be a bunch of, buffoons. They were no fun. The people who were liberal and whatever, they were cool and they did. In retrospect, is it possible that the people who were complaining about losing our moral fiber, did they actually have a point? Should we have listened to them back in the 50s?
I think there is something to that that's playing out in the kind of slippery slope arguments that might have sounded ridiculous back then, but here we are today. And I don't think the answer to that is necessarily government control over what the media can or cannot do or say or publish, but I think we need, as individuals, to exercise control over what media we're putting into our brains in the same way that we would exercise thoughtfulness and care about what we're putting into our bodies. I mean, it's the same, in fact, perhaps even more important, what we put into our minds, because you can't unwatch what you've watched or unsee what you've seen, and that can shape our everyday behaviors. As you point out, to people going back as far back as Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays and others were literally writing about how it was the shaping of the conscious habits of society that was the ultimate end goal of the propagandists. Because if you were able to shape people's everyday habits and behaviors, then you've got them in a way that's much more powerful than just giving them slogans or something. You've really got them the bull by the horns, as it were. And that's the state that we're in right now.
Do you think there's... Once, assuming we lose what people might call our moral fiber, all right, and we can say, all right, since World War II, it's been diminished dramatically. Can it be regained in a relatively short period of time? Is it gone forever? And we've probably only, maybe we'll have to save that question until after the break because there's only about 15 seconds left. So I guess we'll do that. We'll find out what James thinks about regaining our moral fiber when we return on Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Addis. We're going to take a couple of commercials and we'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
We'll be right back. Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk here on Financial Survival with our guest James Corbett from the Corbett Report at CORBETTReport.com. Again, some of the best, most intelligent commentary you're going to find on the internet. We were talking about, when we broke for commercials, we were talking about moral fiber. We had mentioned and explored the idea, or at least considered the idea, that you must be a moral people to become a prosperous people. There's a requirement. You cannot be immoral and, in general, come to a happy ending. You could, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton might dispute that, but for most people, you've got to be a moral individual to become prosperous. And I was asking James if we've lost a lot of our moral principles since World War II. What are the chances that we can regain them, and can they and as the next point, can they be regained painlessly, or do we have to be put through a kind of earthly purgatory before people finally say, I think I got to start being a moral man?
Well, that's really the question, isn't it? And that the answer to that question will determine so much about the possibilities for humankind itself, not to speak too grandiose, but I think it really is. And let me relate a little story that I think relates to this. People may have heard of Bana Alobed, is a 7-year-old purporting to be from East Aleppo, who is tweeting and has hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter with her 7-year-old commentary about what's happening in Syria. Basically, she's a propaganda tool that's being used by her parents as a mouthpiece to pump the why won't someone come in and bomb this country to save it line that is so popular with the U.S. establishment, which is why she's been featured on CNN reading a teleprompter and all of this kind of really nonsense. I mean, it's horrific to think this 7-year-old is being used in this manner, but at any rate, that's what it is. And so as a result of the sort of exposure of the PR aspects of this 7-year-old's Twitter account, there was a kind of parody Twitter account set up by someone saying they were, I think, a 4-year-old from Syria or something that's tweeting about the war and making parody tweets like, I'm 4 years old and today my nursery school was bombed. And many children died, and I'm crying tears about this. Also about manspreading on public transport in New York City or something. Pointing out the kind of ridiculous concerns that seem to be occupying or preoccupying a lot of the American consciousness at the time when, you know, there are real concerns that, that people face on a daily basis of real death and destruction going on. And the American people and people in many developed countries, to be fair, seem so sheltered from that reality that they're starting to find more, ever more and more ridiculous things to get outraged or upset or consumed by. And I think the reason that that kind of parody is so funny is because there is this kind of underlying idea that we've lost connection with whatever it is that our ancestors had to struggle with to find even the modicum of freedom that we enjoy today, such as it may be disappearing. The kind of incredible struggles that previous generations have gone through, and real sacrifices that have been made, and real warfare and bloodshed and all of that, and we're so sheltered from that, which is a wonderful thing to think about. We've grown up in this world where we don't have to face these kinds of horrific things, but it makes it certainly does make for an ever decreasingly realistic sense of what the problems in the world really are for most people. And the danger of that is the sort of mentality is, well, what we need is a good war to get people awake again. You know, people need something to fight for and bloodshed, and they need to feel that sacrifice and that pain in order to understand what's really important again. And I fear that that's the case. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. Maybe we can, as human beings, find a way to give meaning to our lives without disintegrating into bloodshed and violence, and well, people have to die, and we have to feel all this pain in order to understand what's real in life. I'd like to think that we don't have to go through that, but at any rate, we're going through a civilizational change at this point, where that's going to come to a head one way or another, and it looks more and more like it will come to some sort of military confrontation, doesn't it? Just given the proliferation of events around the world that lead in that direction.
Well, when you say military confrontation, are we talking about something akin to World War III, or are we talking about another skirmish?
Well, I mean, in the context of what we're talking about here, making people, realize and snap out of their kind of petty concerns that have consumed them, I think we'd be looking at any rate, something that actually affected people in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of these petty skirmishes that that basically are fought through drone warfare or whatever, where maybe a few servicemen die, maybe. And but something, on the scale of what the kind of ravaging effects of World War II or something like that.
You're living in Japan. You're close to Korea, reasonably close. I'm sure you're, are you 500 miles away? How far are you from North Korea right now?
That's actually a good question. I haven't done the math of how many miles I am, but at any rate, I'm certainly within shooting distance.
Yeah, I understand that. So you've got a different perspective on this. You've got a place to look and see what's happening where you're closer than we are, than I am for sure. What do you see coming out of the Korean Peninsula?
At this precise moment, right now, there is at least a tiny glimmer of hope that this may actually resolve in, or at least progress in some manner that's better than what we've been seeing in the last few months, and that's because of the election of the new president, Moon Jae-in, who campaigned on and seems to be following through on promises to actually restore the so-called Sunshine Policy, which is basically a South Korean political policy of engagement with North Korea rather than drawing battle lines and talking tough, which is what the previous president was doing. So this new president is appointing people to his cabinet who have direct experience with North Korea, have even visited, or even, I think one of them actually said they lived in North Korea for 2 years. I have to get on the details of that. But at any rate, people who know something about the North Koreans and are committed to trying to open dialogue of some sort rather than, as I say, the kind of animosity and trading barbs that have been taking place in recent years. That is, I think, a real reason for hope, because people who only follow the 24-hour news cycle probably will not remember, but back in 1994, there was an agreement signed for the denuclearization of Korea, and towards that, there was significant progress in the years following that. In the late 90s, the South and North Korea were, there was a definite detente, and there were closer relations as part of the Sunshine Policy. That was derailed in 2002, deliberately so by the Bush administration, and the effect of that derailing was the ramping up of the North Korean nuclear program, and obviously the successful completion of their first nuclear warheads. So we know what direction the talking tough and the battle lines goes, and we can see that some sort of thawing of relations may actually be possible by engagement rather than disengagement. So there is actually some glimmer of opportunity for something approaching hope at this precise moment if Moon Jae-in is allowed to pursue this policy in defiance, really, of the current administration in Washington and elsewhere.
Kim Jong-un appears to the West, at least, to be something like a rabid dog. And in the event that we have this new sunshine policy coming out of South Korea, is Kim likely to respond positively, or will he insist on the need to be able to launch more ICBMs? And part of the implication, did Kim's apparent rabidness, was it conducive to restoring the Sunshine Policy?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think that feeds into the question about the cyclical nature of this ramping up of the North Korean threat, which happens usually every spring, usually coincidentally, right after the U.S. and South Korea practice their invasion of the Korean Peninsula in an annual military exercise they hold every single spring. And that's exactly when North Korea starts talking tough and sending out all these messages. So I think there's some relation there. So it's the dog that barks that gets fed, and this happens on a regular basis enough that there is something to that. But I think that the change, if anything, that a real, true attempt at engagement, if that was positively met by North Korea, would change that cyclical process. Rather than having to bark in order to get fed, I think that might change the relationship into one where there doesn't need to be that bark in order to get fed. Now, that's the aspiration, I think, of this process, and whether or not it will or could achieve that will ultimately be seen by, you know, what eventuates on the North Korean side, whether they would be open to that, and whether such a thing would be scuttled by the U.S. and China and other interests that like to meddle in what's happening on the Korean Peninsula. But the point is, we won't know until it is tried, and it hasn't been tried with Kim Jong-un. So we really don't know what kind of leader he really is, because no one has, at this point, really attempted thoroughgoing engagement with North Korea under his leadership.
You wrote an article... published an article on your blog called "What Are You Going to Be When You Grow Up?" But you have the image, we already talked about this before the program began, but you have an interesting image that opened of yourself, the picture. They caught you just at exactly the right moment to catch kind of a peculiar gleam in your eye, which reminded me, as I told you, Dr. Strangelove, Peter Sellers a little bit. But it was an interesting argument. What are you going to be when you grow up? I point out that people would ask me when I was a child, young boy, what are you going to be when you grow up? Well, we had an answer for that. You wanted to be a fireman. You wanted to be an astronaut. You wanted to be, a heavy equipment operator. We had, because the occupations were there and were going to be there. But you point out, right now, whatever career we choose may not even exist. If a child chooses, well, I want to be this, it might not even exist 10 years, 15, 20 years from now. That career may be gone. And what career he gets may be something that does not yet even exist. And you explore this idea, which I think is interesting, and you use it to raise a couple of questions. What does this say about the ability of people to manage or direct the economy if no one knows what's even going to be here 10, 15, 20 years from now? And you ask, what if I told you no one could direct the economy and that was a good thing? What if I told you that the greatest trick the ruling class ever pulled was getting us to believe that we needed them in the first place, presumably to direct our affairs? got about 3 minutes left. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yes, well, obviously, this is a topic that I've been thinking about more and more in recent years, or really in recent months, as my boy is now 4 years old. And mm-hmm. But so he's a typical four-year-old boy, and he's interested in construction vehicles and in trucks and trains and things. And so I jokingly say to him, oh, do you want to be a construction worker when you grow up? Do you want to be a truck driver? Do you want to be a train conductor? Whatever it is that we're looking at the moment. And he says, yeah, yeah. And I say, well, I'm not sure that'll exist when you're ready to join the workforce. And it's true. There's so many of those types of jobs where I'm really not convinced there'll be jobs for him by the time he reaches that. Maybe he can program the driverless cars or whatever it is that will be the job of the future. But and it's a real phenomenon that's happening now. I mean, obviously there have been changes in society before. The Industrial Revolution and others have changed the nature of work for many people, but I think it's accelerating at this yes. point, and obviously I think apparently so. So again, there are negative aspects to this. There is something comforting about having a somewhat predictable life where you can join a company and work for it for 50 years and retire with a golden handshake and, you know, have done your part. That concept is pretty much shattered at this point, and it can be a scary thing. But I think the flip side of this is that we should not desire, or we shouldn't at least hold the illusion that any political messiah is going to come down and direct the economy. Because the economy isn't a thing. It is the spontaneous interactions of millions or billions of people who are interacting in whatever ways that are available to them to try to meet their needs. And I think the more we expect that someone is even capable of directing that. It's not a question of this person is, oh, I prefer this person to direct the economy rather than that one. No one is capable of doing that, and nor should they attempt to do so, because intervention generally only ever screws things up. So, having said that, I think the argument is one for a different understanding of the economy than what we have. And the term that I like to use is catalaxy, which comes from an obscure form of economics, but basically it's the idea of that the economy, as we understand it, is really just the sum total of interactions between free people, and they are not, it is not a thing, it is not a process to be directed, it is not an engine that needs refueling or things like this, the types of metaphors we use to talk about the economy.
Then what you're implying is that the more government interferes, the less prosperous the economy is going to be, and you've got about 10 seconds to answer.
That is always and forever the case, but it's impossible to prove the negatives. So there will always be people who say, well, if we didn't have government, this or that, but you can't prove the negative. But I am 100% convinced that government intervention only skews the market. It never fundamentally helps it.
All right, James, thanks very much for being on the program. I always enjoy talking to you. I want to thank everyone in the audience for listening. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd, the producer, and James Corbett. Bye-bye.
Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.